We're talking with Brad Steiger, who with his wife Sherry Steiger wrote this new book about strange beings and other dimensions. When we come back in this half hour, I want to jump into goblins, elves, and weird creatures, men in black, and whatever else we can get to. Then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be opening up the phone lines for your calls and questions from my guest. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Brad Steiger, I'm going to jump around a little bit in this segment because there's a lot of ground I want to cover. Before we open up the phone lines, the first one being Hitler. You got a chapter in your new book about the master race from inner Earth. And we've all read about Hitler's interest in paranormal and strange topics. And we've seen the Indiana Jones movie about the Nazis going after ancient treasures and mystical objects. But you really go into detail here and make the case that it's true, that he really did have an interest in this and pursued it with great vigor.
Well, it's fascinating for anyone such as myself who grew up during that period, during the Second World War. And uncles and cousins went off. Many didn't come back. My cousin on the English side flew his P-40 out of London. He showed this to us in an aviation history book. He's in the aviation history books as being one of the first, if not the first, to shoot down a German jet. Now, the interesting thing, and I knew this because he watched that pilot going down in his parachute, and they kept in touch. They visited each other in the summers. Now, this cousin who was an ace, one of the first to shoot down a Nazi jet, also had sightings of these objects that they called Foo Fighters, which came from the French for fire, because they were like fireballs flying among them. So I had, since I was a wee lad, the concept that they had secret weapons that they never quite got around. The jet airplane, that was secret weapon enough. And the Brits can tell horrible stories about the Blitzkrieg there. But the fact that they were still working with something else. And then, of course, with Operation Paperclip, when they brought, just a whole village of Nazi scientists over to begin working on our jet and space program. All of these things seemed very real to me. And then when I began exploring, again, going back to secret societies, we've written this book, Sherry and I, Conspiracies and Secret Societies, and we've always been fascinated by the fact that there are secret societies, and they did do things in various, and they're doing things now. But the concept then that we had a group of ladies who served as mediums bringing information from an outer space source, channeling this information to the Germans and the Nazis, we should say, to develop this type of technology. And then the incredible thing of Hitler, and I was fortunate to, after World War II, there were a number of professors who had fled Germany, Nazi Germany, and come to the United States, with whom I became very good friends. I mentioned the discussion with Dr. Weilgart in the book. I have some of this material in the book in great detail of how he got out of Nazi Germany. His father was one of the biggies in the Nazi party and wanted Junior, of course, to follow him. But no, there were many like that who got here. At any rate, I think that this whole idea of going to collect particular artifacts to bring power to them, and the female mediums, who, if you look at pictures of them, they don't look like women from 1920. they look like young starlets of today. They just look so modern in their appearance. And I have heard, and I think it's a reliable source, that this particular society, if you will, has begun again in Italy. Not Germany this time, but is beginning to stoke its fires in Italy.
Jumping now, Jacques Vallée, I mentioned earlier in the program, and a contemporary of yours, the late John Keel, a couple of others in the UFO field, myself included, have come to the same place, the same sort of conclusion about there's somehow a connection that UFOs are about much more than off-world beings and flying saucers from other planets or dimensions, and a connection to very down-to-earth creatures like elves and fairies and goblins, the kind of stories that have been within human lore and mythology for a long time. Talk to me about some stories that resonate with you that are included in the new book that you find to be credible to suggest that there really are creatures like this running around or have been.
Well, again, I'm of Scandinavian heritage, so that may well be, as I said earlier, why the activating incident for me at age 5 was that of an elf, a nissa, as we would have called it in Norwegian. The idea then that these entities were, first of all, we can say, were they actually human or humanoids or homonyms? Because we have found now what we call the hobbits. They are Florensis species that were, you know, what would be the size of an elf, roughly 3.5 or 4 feet tall. So we have the evidence now coming up in my book, Worlds Before Our Own. I predicted then that there would be at least 5 or 6 human hominid species in the next several decades, and we certainly are gaining that now with the Denisovans and now the mystery species that we, somewhere between Denisovans, which they probably propagated with, and then the hobbits. And throughout then, there has been the story of this smaller species that coexists with us. But then there is the other side, the supernatural side. And again, as Vallée and Keel did, we see the same. I mean, it's precisely the same. There's the missing time aspect where, Patrick going off to the market sees these wee people dancing around, and we have a number of stories in the book where people have encountered dancing, always dancing. Now, is that a hypnotic circle going around that lures people in? People think, oh, that was fine. I spent 2 hours with the wee people before I came to town. And then they say, Patrick, we've been looking for you for a week. Or it works the other way. He thinks he's been gone for a week, and he's only been gone for a few days. Though the fairy circle, when we first went out looking at UFO landing sites, they weren't the marvelous masterpieces of architecture and everything woven into it. They were just the circles about, just the right size that we imagined that these spaceships would be. But they looked for all the world like fairy circles. And then, as we noted and researchers noted, nothing grew there again. Maybe only thing that grew there were toadstools. And that fits right in with the mythology. So we have, again, an overlap of when does it become a multidimensional series of interactions with humans, and when is it an echo? As I said, it's got to be teaching us something. And one of the things that I predicted in the 50s is we're going to continue to find new species, which we have. So we've always troubled ourselves. No, excuse me. We haven't troubled ourselves until recent years with the big question we all have, who are we? Who are we really, and why are we here, and what is our purpose? And then, are we alone? Those are the questions that have driven us for centuries.
Well, I can see people saying, oh, come on, elves, fairies, goblins, come on, man, that's a little too much. They can believe in aliens, but not something from folklore, even though it might very well be the same thing.
The same thing. Young researchers who are catching on to this, they'll write to me, and they've gone through this old book and that old book, and they say, you're right, it's the same thing, it's the same modus operandi.
Well, I heard a lot of those stories about little people from Native Americans during the time
Oh,
we were working
yes.
on the Skinwalker book. And I'm not talking about ancient legends. I'm talking
No.
about experiences they've had in the last couple of years, we people running around in their homes.
Absolutely. And the Eastern tribes call them Pukwudgeni, which I think is so incredible because we have over in England, we have Puck. We have the marvelous, mischievous Puck. And here we have the, particularly the Eastern tribes calling them Pukwudgeni.
Let's cover one more topic in this segment before we open up the phone lines, and that's Men in Black. You're one of the few guys around who lived through that era, who was studying these phenomena during what could be called maybe the golden age of these Men in Black, people showing up with the dark cars and the dark sunglasses to intimidate witnesses to UFO and other paranormal events. Describe, pick a story. Tell me about a Men in Black episode that might illustrate what the typical experience is. And then tell me, are they earthlings? Are they off-world beings? What the heck is going on there?
Okay, the basic modus operandi here is an individual has a UFO sighting, and he takes his camera and he gets a good picture and he talks about it. He talks, "I got this really good picture. Boy, if I could show this around, everyone would believe." And then there comes the knock at the door, and there are three men dressed in black. They have a vague kind of semi-Asian appearance. They are not that tall, and they threaten. They say, "Now you must turn over this evidence for your good, for the good of your country, and for the good of your world." Now, early on, I blamed
The Air Force?
no, I blamed a particular UFO civilian group
Oh.
who had a name which suggested that they had authority from Washington, D.C.
NICAP?
Okay, you said it. I wasn't going to. So I blamed NICAP and got into some real catfights with them, saying, "You guys are doing this. You've got, a bunch of teenagers. They're enthusiastic. They knock at the door and they say, 'I'm from Washington. Turn this over.'" But again, they took great umbrage at that and said, no. And then it was the Air Force. And I think some of these things, I had a friend who, because I know him, I trust him, and he was a tough guy, it seemed to be Air Force there. He said that they were in uniform. So it's probably a hodgepodge, it's the potpourri of Men in Black. Now, when I first heard about that was, when John Keel took me for my first Chinese dinner in New York. I'd never had Chinese dinner before. And when we went back to his apartment, he told me of a visitation of the Men in Black to him, where they had come in and reached below the sink and took some bleach, and they took turns drinking it to prove that they were not of our kind and that he had better knock off his investigations. Now, that scared the heck out of me because, I was 30 years old. I'm in New York for the first time, and I thought I was, I mean, I weight lifted. I was, I felt I was really in fantastic shape. But when I went back to my hotel that night, I was looking over my shoulder and I thought, since I'm alone, this is when I went out to finish the Valentino book, when the publisher brought me out to finish the deadline. And I expected any minute there'd be a knock, knock at the door and three men in black would be there. Never happened. But the interesting thing for me, George, is my friends. I have lost, I put it in proper. I've lost many friends who refused to have anything to do with me at the time because they got the calls. And some of these were military individuals. A friend of mine who's with Special Forces, I mean, he literally dared them to come, and they did. But he said, beat it. He then had his friends in the law enforcement. He took down the license plate and they said there is no such license plate, and he described the vehicle, and people said there's no such vehicle. So whatever this was, here again, it's, we can talk about this when we talk about Slender Man, when we talk about the shadow people. It's a meme. It's something, it's a contagion of the psyche, where if some people have these terribly horrible, convincing stories, then it's going to spread. It's going to spread as soon as everyone is having Men in Black. But there was a time when there really was a great concern that we were being spied upon by, who were they, extraterrestrial bodyguards or thugs or...
Some of the accounts are certainly seem like they're not exactly human. I mean, pretty weird stories. And it's like somebody just says, let's throw this into the mix, Men in Black scaring the heck out of people. Let's see how the crazy humans react to this one and then laugh about it.
That's where I am now. That's where I am now. This intelligence, perhaps a negative or playful side of it, said exactly what you're saying.
What do you make of
this in the mix?
What about UFO editorials, these off-world editorials, ETs saying, you guys better shape up, you're destroying your planet, here's what's going to happen, show you a movie of the destruction of the world, and then, you know, it's a prediction, a dire prediction meant to scare the bejesus out of us, and the predictions, at least so far, haven't come true.
No, and that's what really, when I heard enough of those, and I say from people who could not have known each other. We didn't have internet then. People didn't freely use the phone in the 60s and 50s because it was expensive. So people I just knew, because I was fortunate to have friends who had airplanes, and a couple of them had encountered UFOs in Korea, in the Korean conflict. They, in their new jets now, remember, they're just coming out, were made fools of, they felt, by these objects. So they said, heck yes, I'll take you here, I'll take you there. So that was very useful to me, early days, to be flown around like that, where I would meet people in one part of the country and go to the next telling exactly the same story. I knew they couldn't be making it up, but why was it the same story about shape up, or we're going to ship you out, we're going to take over your planet, or it's going to crush, you've got to mend your ways, you must be respectful to the Earth Mother, you must take care of her. Well, I'm happy to hear that from my shaman friends. When Sherry and I visited and studied with them, they're talking about the Earth Mother, our respect and our love. But did they come from Alpha Centauri to tell us the same thing?
Well, you tell me. I mean, those are pretty common stories for a while.
I say no. I say this is the same intelligence. And the message is vital. The message is necessary. The message is important. We must take care of our planet. We must be kinder to each other. And I think, undeniably, human evolution is not completed. We are continuing to evolve.
We got a minute and a half, maybe, until this next break. Actually, it's probably a minute. I was going to try to get you to tell me the story of Stick Man, but that probably is not possible in a minute. Let's save that for the other side. Well, we got 2 minutes. Can you give me a synopsis of the story of Stick Man in Tennessee that you tell in the book?
Yeah, well, this is, again, people I trust, people who have been in their own way. They come from different service backgrounds. They've encountered things. This was an entity that appeared, and we have to recognize then that this is, and I pointed this out and others to the individual, when they first began encountering this tall object, it was just stick in the head and arms. And then I said, but the Native Americans in your area decades ago talked of this same kind of entity. Well, they saw, and we have a drawing that one of the witnesses did. It is that. It's simply a tall stick man that appears. And again, the message in seeing him, and people go to YouTube. There is something of a stick man, but this is obviously people with sheets wrapped around them and walking on stilts. Stick man is just that. It's like a head and bony arms. And then also we pointed out there are some petroglyphs that Native Americans have left in different parts of the country. That, again, is this tall entity, just practically a stick with stick-like arms but a head.
He's got a head that looks like an alien, though. Been seen in Middle Tennessee and other places. If you get the book, you can check it out. The guy's supposedly over 7 feet tall. Much more to cover here with Brad Steiger. When we come back, Brad Steiger answers your questions and concerns, and we might even talk about the Mothman a little bit. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Brad Steiger, one other question before we go to the phones. It's about your colleague, John Keel, who wrote about the Mothman. I saw a story a week or so ago that someone was trying to explain away all the events in Point Pleasant and West Virginia back there during that era. They said that a special unit of Green Berets had been doing some nighttime parachute jumping with some kind of weird parachute, and that explains it away. It reminds me of the story about how Roswell aliens were really just mannequins that were tossed out of planes. Right. What's your take on that?
Well, the same as the Roswell mannequins that were tossed out on from the plane. Yes, that offers a very neat explanation, and now the mystery is over, except the people who, I mean, some of these explanations, we have to give average people, you know, more credit for basic intelligence. And yes, we can all be fooled. Yes, we've seen things in the sky that are unidentified. Because they're simply unidentified, it doesn't mean they're terrestrial, extraterrestrial, or just some natural phenomenon. So again, that the Green Beret training, I really think that the people in the descriptions described and as John then told me, you know, that kind of led to, well, come back to my apartment, let's talk more from dinner, was, you know, the phone calls that he received and the, you know, Ingrid Cold and the various entities. And that was true of the individuals there. And it's also the prophecy and all of that that tied in. John did a marvelous job of incorporating this, you know, as one solid set piece. So we can come up with, you know, really jazzy little explanations of way past the time, and some people will be satisfied because they don't want to face the unknown. They don't want to talk about the supernatural, the paranormal. So, wow, what a relief. Once again, we owe our debt to the Green Beret.
Well, it struck me as that could be a rational explanation for part of what people saw, but not even close to it. Full range of experiences that people reported, close-up encounters and voices on the phone and all kinds of other things, sure.
Right.
But nice try.
The Green Beret had no reason to participate on all those activities.
Yeah, nice try by someone, though. Let's go to the phones. Wildcard line, Mike in San Diego. Hi, Mike. How you doing?
Hi, I'm okay. How are you tonight?
All right, what's on your mind?
Well, my mom had a sighting in 1962 to 1963. It was one of those years. And I'm wondering how you can definitively tell the difference between whether the Men in Black came out or if it was the Blue Book. And how are you doing, Brad?
I'm doing fine, Mike. Thanks for the question. That's a tough one. I think we can almost immediately eliminate Blue Book.
Okay.
Yeah, as you may know, an attorney in New York, a very brilliant attorney, sued the Freedom of Information Act and turned all the Blue Book files over to me, and then I edited it in the 70s. And I saw nothing there that would indicate they sent three men out. They would send out investigators, or they would let it be known that they were open. As far as others investigating, did she have an experience where men came and interviewed her?
Yes, and they came within the hour.
Within the hour.
Wow. Right. And did they wear uniforms, or what did they look like?
Black suits, hats?
Well, when I asked her for those details, she was so upset. And the expression in her eyes, what she did say was that they were dressed professionally,
mm-hmm.
and that they were very serious. And my mother worked in a tough area of town. She worked in an Italian restaurant in Little Italy. And you know what that was like in the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
She was a tough woman. So for her to be afraid.
Or intimidated.
Yes. She was not easily intimidated. No, she was a fighter.
Well, so, I would really like more information about this, because people have had genuine experiences, what whatever this is, whether they're tulpas, whether they're entities created by the mind, whether there's some secret society. Some people had frightening. I've interviewed people who were hit in the face, who were belittled, who were attacked, and they were spied on for weeks after their sighting. So we can't just say all of this, you know, and go wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You know, it just didn't happen. It happened to many, many people. And they have frightening stories to tell. So, you know, if you can talk to your mom about it or remember it and send it, I would really like it for the files. I would appreciate that very much.
And, Mike, we have a link on the Coast to Coast website and how you can get a hold of Brad Steiger. If you want to go there, you can get in touch with him. Thanks for the call.
We're still researching these things, you know.
We have another Mike, this one in Cleveland on a wild card line. Hi, Mike. How you doing?
Excellent. Good evening, George and Brad.
Hi, Mike.
Bless your healing, George.
Thank you.
Brad, Rick Strassman's book, DMT, Spirit Molecule, he documents people's DMT experiences that seem to have both the fairy and elf quality, as well as the fractal geometry.
Mm-hmm.
And the pineal gland's DMT could possibly be the source of near-death experiences when released in a dying brain. So, Brad, do you think there's universal connection with the human brain there?
I think there's universal connection. That's one thing that we believe very strongly, that why are these happening? It's part of the oneness. We are all one. And the more scientists get into this with the different dimensions and the multiverses and the all of this seems to indicate that we truly are all one and we are linked by subtle things, whether it's as dramatic as the pineal gland. You know, who can say? This is still being researched and exciting research in many areas are being accomplished.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Cheryl in Texas. How you doing, Cheryl?
I'm doing fine, George, and I'm so glad that you just sound so well.
Well, thank you very much.
I have something. I've been having an inner conflict, Brad,
mm-hmm.
and I'm very intrigued by your book and by what you're saying because I have had several near-death experiences,
mm-hmm.
and it started like 29 years ago was the first core NDE I had. And I've had a lot of paranormal experiences since that time, which I know are normal, because have you ever heard of Dr. Kenneth Ring?
Oh, yes.
Okay, he's a friend of mine, a personal friend of mine. I've known him for like 30 years. And at any rate, are you aware, too, that he wrote a book about the relationship between abductees and NDEers?
Yes, I am.
Okay. You know, at first I really didn't give too much thought to that. But over the last few years, I'm wondering, why am I not, like wowed over things that I used to be wowed over, like these other paranormal experiences that people have had, like upright walking dogs and Sasquatch and all of that. It's like I've also witnessed a UFO on several occasions,
mm-hmm.
and had just about every kind of paranormal experience you can imagine. But yet, when I hear other people saying, oh, I saw an elf, it's like, oh, okay, so what, you know?
Right. That's because you've had the experience. The near-death experience certainly is a crash course in phenomena, isn't it? So, yes, you have that attitude. Perhaps Sherry and I could have that too, because, I mean, we try to think of something we haven't seen, and then we think, oh, we're not tempting you, we're not tempting you, the other, don't come up with something drastic. But yes, we maintain an active interest because we are compilers. That's our mission, is to put this together and share it with people. If we, you know, probably had a different mission, we would be much like you. If we've seen ghosts, we've seen entities, we've seen this, you know, so what? But to us, it's continually exciting, it's continually rewarding, and it's something we feel that people need to understand that, just like you're saying, it's normal. It's normal.
And Cheryl, I'll tell you another side to it is there are a lot of people like me who've been out there looking for it for a long time and haven't seen it, whether it's at Area 51 or the Bigelow Ranch in Utah, have never seen it. and are jealous of people like you who've had these experiences. We're going to Jeff in Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, Jeff.
Greetings and salutations. I wanted to challenge your guest tonight on dinosaurs. The scriptures many times talks about dinosaurs, and there have been drawings in walls and caves on men fighting dinosaurs. And if it's supposedly 65 million years ago, could you tell me, and I tell people you can believe anything you want, evolution, whatever you wish, why man's footprints and dinosaurs' footprints have been found in Glen Rose, Texas?
Well, I can tell you I have written chapter after chapter in Glen Rose, Texas. That's what I can tell you.
Okay. But if the dinosaurs were not here when man was here all these millions of years ago, supposedly, why are they together? Why are their footprints together?
Well, you probably believe as I do. How could a comet, how could anything wipe out millions of particular species? There's several species in one shot. Maybe the stories of George fighting the dragon, maybe other sightings, maybe the very fact that we do find what look very much like the great reptiles, we find in many cave drawings. So maybe some survived, right?
I would say they survived, and as opposed to the comet hitting the earth, what about the flood? Do you believe in the flood?
I believe there are floods, yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks for
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
First-time caller Michael in New York City. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Hey there. How's it going? Yeah, really, George, glad to hear you're recovering. And Brad, you sound like an amazing person. I wanted to ask you about angelic names that have been passed down throughout history. I think it's funny that I'm the third Michael to be calling. Right?
Yeah, it's Michael Knight. It's Michael Knight here on Coast to Coast.
But I personally have been, since I was a child, actually, in communication. I don't know if it's a tulpa or my higher self or something, but he's always identified as Azrael, which is a very common angelic name. I was wondering, do you find a lot of people throughout, I guess, your investigations who have recurring names that you've heard?
Oh, yes, yes, and that's certainly one of them. And I very much like the fact that you mentioned tulpa. So that tells me that you have research, you have studied the area, and I appreciate that very much. But yes, we have, we've written, six, seven books on angels, and we're fascinated by the fact how universal angels are. We have three of our books, angel books, published in Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country in the world. So we know that all faiths, all religions recognize the angels, the angelic host, or whatever you want to call them.
Michael, so how long has this been happening to you? Over what period of time and how many encounters?
Gosh, I can't even remember how many encounters at this point, but the first time I ever really had any, I think my first real experience was when I was about 8 years old. I was like a very bad situation when I was a kid, and I was left alone a lot, and I actually experienced, I'm sure you've heard about people seeing orbs, and I saw probably about four orbs, red orbs, that spoke into my mind. I mean, you know, I don't talk to most people about this, obviously, but since I was a kid, and then when I got to be a teenager, I would do a lot of meditation and would come to this voice that I could actively have conversations with. And it's actually a little disturbing. I was wondering, a secondary question, I'll try to make it quick. Have you heard of people saying that they've heard of imminent, catastrophe? Because I've definitely been given the message multiple times that if people don't manage to change soon, that there could be some really, really devastating things that happen. Have you heard anything about that?
Oh, yes, yes. We've heard that now for decades, and there seems to be the warning part of it. But again, as you said, you don't talk to many people about it. We would love to have the accounts. We have so many. We'll let you know where you are common with others. We'll let you know where you're unique. We'll be happy to do that. We really are trying to research all areas just as completely as we can. So,
I'll be in touch. I looked at that thing on the website, definitely.
Terrific. We'll be looking forward to hearing from you.
Brad, we're almost out of time. Got a couple of minutes left. Do you think the net effect of all the different kind of phenomena that you talk about in this book, all the different kinds of stories and creatures and entities, is to prepare us for something that we talked about it earlier, about it being a learning curve, but that it's conditioning us for something, and if so, what that is?
All I can do is conjecture, as you do, George. We very definitely feel it. As this young man said, as many, many others, revelators, we call them. Not that they're prophets, but this is the individual mystical experience. And along with that does come, for some, a gift of prophecy. We always caution people to be very, very, selfish with their prophecies, because there is also the negative side. Some people have made successful prophecies, then it kind of goes to their head, and then they make a great prophecy, and they're humiliated. So given prophecies can be a testing of the individual revelator, or the individual who has had this experience. So always stay in balance. Always try to stay, look on the rational, and combine it and see that all is one, and we're all on this path. We are all on our journey, and we must exercise care, caution, and love.
Well, there are hucksters, there are tricksters, there are crooks out there who would manipulate us, take our money, stuff up, and there is also, as you note in the book, true evil.
That's right. It took a while for me to accept that. I mean, come on, the modern age, evil, ha, 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 that goes for old scriptures and so forth. But then, investigating haunted houses and haunted areas, when you come up against something that pushes you, shoves you, snaps things, breaks down doors in front of you, you feel that can't be wanting to do you any good.
I don't think I want to encounter one of those.
Well, it certainly was a life-altering experience for me.
Got any other projects you want to tell us about real quick?
We're researching right now. We're putting our attention on this book. This book is very important to us. We feel, with our personal experiences and others. And we're researching for another book. And we're getting to the age where we're cautious with our time and energy, and we want to, every book that comes from our processors now, we want it to be the very best that it can be.
Well, this is a culmination of many years of work, and I think you do a great job of sort of tying it all together.
Thank you.
The book is called Real Encounters, Different Dimensions and Otherworldly Beings by Brad Steiger and Sherry Hansen Steiger. And it's just been a great pleasure to talk with you, Brad.
Well, same. We've talked about you and said for years, boy, we'd like to get together with George sometime. So right back at you. It's been a pleasure. And sorry to hear of your illness. Take care of yourself. We can't lose you.
Well, luckily, I happen to be indestructible, so I'm going to be around.
I used to think that too, my friend.
thanks very much, Brad Steiger. And
Thank you so much.
I encourage people to check out the book. It covers a lot of ground that is familiar to us here on this program. I told you we had a heck of a show coming up. William J. Burns has written a new book with his co-author Joel Martin. It's called The Haunting of 21st Century America. And it sounds like it's a book about poltergeists, but it's not. It's the third in a trilogy that Bill and Joel have put together, and it is a blockbuster of a book. When we come back, Bill Burns will join me to talk about it. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.